Brexit's connection to the R word, racism. It is at once obvious but considered mischievous and impolitic to point it out. But today we discuss a new book that does just that.
We have no control on the numbers of people coming into our country, and one of the main reasons I want Brexit is I want back control of our borders.
We're full. We can't take any more physically. There's no housing. There's nowhere for any of them to live.
We have to, in this campaign, make people understand that EU membership and uncontrolled immigration are synonymous with each other.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host, Zoe Williams. Our guest on today's show is Martin Shaw, an Emeritus Professor in International Relations at the University of Sussex and the author of a new book, Political Racism: Brexit and Its Aftermath. We'll be looking back on the history of Brexit and the way in which it has legitimised a dangerous new nationalism, authoritarianism, and racism.
Hi, this is Elena. Back in the 2016 referendum, I was just your regular politically active migrant. So I was so happy when I found Another Europe is possible. I grew up in Bulgaria, and my opportunities to move to the UK 8 years ago to study and to change my life and to change my politics even basically came through membership of the European Union. So it's sad that we're now living through the Brexit that we warned about back then, but that's why we need to keep going, because none of the issues and none of the problems have gone away. So that's why I think you should join us today. Go to anothereurope.org and you can get access to an extended version of this podcast by making Another Europe is Possible your home too.
Hi, Martin. Now, can you talk about the motivation in writing this book? Why do you think it's been so hard to use the R word when discussing Brexit?
Well, it's nice to be here and to talk to you. I think my motivation for writing this was really goes right back to 2016 and the referendum and my own experience of the referendum. I suppose, like a lot of people, I wasn't as prepared as I should have been, really, for what was going to happen in general, and in particular, the way in which the Leave campaign was going to be run. I mean, I hadn't read all the research, which I've now read, on the history of the Brexit movement and you know, how we got to where we were in 2016. And so, like many people, I think I was shocked as I became aware of the extent of the racism being used not only by the Farage Leave.eu operation, which one would have expected, but also by Vote Leave, the mainstream campaign, the officially recognised campaign run by Dominic Cummings for Boris Johnson, Michael Gove and other Tory cabinet ministers, and of course headed up also by Gisela Stewart, the Labour MP. So I was initially taken aback, as I think other people who became aware of it were, by the extent of the often quite crude racism in the campaign material. And I began to, you know, to see more clearly, I think, exactly how deep the problems were, which were being brought to the fore by this referendum. And of course, as the violence and abuse that associated with the later stages of the referendum became more and more obvious, the depth of the problem was becoming very clear. But then after the referendum, this perception of the campaign tended to fade away, and many people carried on talking about Brexit as though it had just involved a sort of constitutional change. It was a question of sovereignty. It was a question of economic arrangements, which of course is what the Remain campaigns had focused on. And this history, really, as it had become, of the racist propaganda and campaigning and the racist abuse that accompanied the campaign tended to get marginalised in the understanding of Brexit. So After the event, after having come to terms with this and starting to read more widely into the literature, which was growing, rapidly growing literature about the referendum and about the Leave movement as a whole, I felt really there was a need to research this properly, partly to put on record exactly and to put in clear focus the character of the Leave campaign and what had been really at stake, and to force the debate about Brexit to really confront this element of it. I think that there was a secondary feature here really, which is important, and I think maybe we'll come back to it, which was the perception that it was the racism of the campaign, which was acknowledged to some extent, and certainly there's a lot of the literature on the campaign recognises that immigration was an important issue, but nevertheless there was a perception that this was mainly to do with Nigel Farage, Leave.eu, the breaking point poster, which of course was the emblematic moment, and so the racism of Vote Leave was largely elided, and of course the way in which the two campaigns had collided during the referendum, because they were in many ways bitter rivals initially for the government recognition, and there was a mutual loathing between them. This fed into this perception, I think, because I think Remainers and media commentators and then some scholars as well accepted largely the perception, which was convenient to both sides, that the Vote Leave had fought a sovereigntist campaign which had been above board, and that the immigration issue had been harnessed by Farage. You know, so when that breaking point thing happened, Michael Gove told the BBC that he had shuddered when he saw Farage's poster.
What do you think about that kind of rhetoric?
Well, when I saw that poster, I shuddered. I thought it was the wrong thing to do.
And so he contributed really to the idea that, you know, Vote Leave was innocent of these issues, and that it was Leave.eu which had carried this message forward. And of course, Leave.eu were quite proud to have done so.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Michael Gove's response to the Breaking Point poster, because it's one of the things that stays with me since the referendum campaign, when he was on Andrew Marr's show sofa and he described his horror at what he had seen. And of course, as you suggested, you know, Gove was up to his eyeballs in the Leave campaign's racism. Just, I think it was 1 month earlier, I might have mentioned this on a previous podcast actually, but not for a while, he wrote an article in the Sunday Mail where he argued, and the headline ran, "If you think the EU is bad, wait until Albania and Turkey join." And of course, this was classic dog whistle racist politics. What do those two countries have in common? Well, they have a majority Muslim population, and of course, Islamophobia is one of the most important and fundamental features of racism in Europe in the 21st century. So this was just classic dog whistle politics. And for him to turn around and say that Nigel Farage's Breaking Point posters made him shudder was in entirely a hypocritical reaction.
Because I think it's more than hypocrisy, right? And we discussed this with the kind of Polish left a couple of years ago, that the defence against racist discourses in the public sphere is the soft right, not the left. So, you know, there something did collapse on the soft right rather than it accelerate on the hard right.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I agree. And but I think I would say, in addition to that, that the Leave campaign was a very effective example of what is sometimes referred to as triangulation, in the sense that it had enough progressive slogans. For argument's sake, let's call Take Back Control a progressive slogan. it can certainly be interpreted in a progressive way. So it had that slogan that allowed a lot of people to feel satisfied that they were casting a merely democratic vote. But then it also was able to use very effectively explicit racist slogans, particularly orientated, as we said, towards Turkey's alleged impending membership of the European Union. Note, by the way, that that still hasn't happened 6 years later. So it sort of spoke to all parts of British society.
On that point about take back control, because that slogan really, I think, has to be understood in terms of the logic of immigration control. You know, it very much echoed the consistent demand for immigration control, which had been the staple of the British right over decades and decades. And the slogan itself, I only learned this after I'd finished the book, actually, when I read Michael Crick's biography of Farage. The slogan itself was one which had been used repeatedly by Farage in the context of immigration. So take out control was presented in the referendum and in the press coverage and the Leave papers very much as a question of control over immigration. Because if you think about it, you know, what was there to control? What was there, which, you know, where was the democratic deficit here? What were the things that mattered to people that the EU was stopping the UK doing? And really, they didn't have very much to offer there. The mainstream Tory right were exercised about Britain not being able to do its own trade deals. But very few voters were really concerned about that. No, what mattered to a lot of voters and what the Leave campaigns really meant by that was immigration.
Yeah, I think that's true. I just think that the slogan itself, because it was open pretty clearly to a progressive interpretation, allowed a lot of people that maybe weren't fussed about controlling immigration to see the Brexit vote as a merely democratic exercise in returning power to the UK. So I think it did have these two dimensions to it. One was a kind of traditional democratic, national democratic conception of how a polity should be organised. And it was combined very effectively with this, as you emphasise, nativist view, xenophobia, hard racism, of course. So I think it had both of these sides present in the whole mix. But look, let's move the discussion on, because it's a feature of former empires that they often inherit a racism problem. And Britain is pretty normal in this regard. So what do you think actually changed with the Brexit vote? This also, it brings us back to Zoe's point around the collapse of anti-racism on the soft right. What was different and what was familiar in this political moment of 2016?
Well, I think we probably have to unpack that whole point about empire a little bit more, really, because I think the racism problem in Britain and the way in which racism had come to be expressed around the demand for immigration control really came, I mean, although we can trace deep roots in the long history of the British Empire, it came from the way in which the whole immigration issue had been packaged by the political right and their media in the whole period since the 1950s or early 60s. And I mean, it came from the way in which the citizens of empire had been able to come to the UK, had been able to live in British society and become accepted as British citizens, and the way in which the right had consistently over this very long period mobilised opposition to this overtly, in the case of things like Powell's speeches in 1968, but you know, the whole period leading up to Brexit, the 70-year period really of immigration campaigning. I think this is the long durée which we have to bring to bear. But what of course Brexit really mobilised, which was different, was the resentment at East Europeans coming into Britain, and the way in which after 2004, and especially after 2006, when Farage became leader of UKIP, the campaign focused on the East Europeans. So there was that was the manifest element which was operating here. But the other, of course, was Islamophobia, was the way in which anti-Muslim sentiment had become important after 2001. And this again was something which the whole right was really very exercised about. And this was the subtext, of course, to what you were talking about before, the focus on Turkey and Albania, Muslim countries. David Cameron, in his memoirs, said that you could sum up the Leave campaign as, if you want a Muslim for a neighbour, vote Remain. He didn't say that in 2016, when he was mostly silent about what Leave were doing. But that was these two elements, I think, were the new elements really in the equation. But it drew also on this longer established, very deeply rooted, generalised, mainly anti-black opposition to immigration, which had been cultivated over a long period, and which had been maintained after it became no longer politically correct to be hostile to blacks. Of course, it had been maintained by what I call the numerical racism of, the racialization of the idea of immigrant itself, and the numerical focus, the focus on the targets, the failure of the Tory government to meet its own target of reducing immigration below 100,000 a year.
So it's really key to your argument that it was the mobilisation of racism that made this political project a success. But, there's surely some background to that, which is that there had been kind of really quite vivid racist agendas in the media since, as you say, 2001. So how did it turn into a moment that could deliver something? How did it turn into a demand?
Well, I suppose I think we have to look at the way in which these various demands of the far right and the Tory right, the Europhobic right, interacted with the mainstream leadership of the Conservative Party, particularly in the period of Cameron's leadership. The way in which Farage really mobilised these two key demands: one for a referendum, but the second also for ending East European immigration and for reducing immigration overall very, very, very drastically. And the ways in which Cameron conceded on these two issues by promising the referendum, and before that by promising to reduce net immigration to under 100,000. So these were the key, I think, the key mechanisms. And over this period, the Tory right, which had become more and more Europhobic, responded to the UKIP challenge by increasing the pressure on Cameron, and Cameron increasingly sought to pacify the right in his own party as well as the broader sentiment. And so this dynamic built up to something which could be mobilised in the referendum campaign. The other thing we have to take of here very much is the role of the media and the way in which especially the Tory tabloids presented Eastern European migration in the period in that decade really before the Brexit referendum.
It's very funny. I was interviewing Margaret Beckett yesterday, and she said the reason Cameron was so unprepared was that he'd never had the full force of the Tory press against him. He had no prior concept of what that would feel like, and hadn't prepared for it. And that sort of, that feeds into your argument that actually, until the right was divided, it was impossible to conceive that that element of the right would win. And the thing which divided them was this explicit racist agenda.
Yeah, I think there was always going to be a very strong vote for Brexit, in part because of the way in which our media for multiple generations now has been controlled by a handful of very right-wing individuals that has successfully set the agenda under both Labour and Conservative governments. So under the Labour Blair administration, we had that whole offensive against bogus asylum seekers. And then towards the end of that administration and into the Brown and Cameron years, the agenda moves its fixation towards Eastern European migrants, as Martin said. So they very successfully have set the agenda for a long time. And I think Margaret Beckett makes a very good point. You know, Cameron, like his predecessors in both the Labour and Conservative parties, was very scared of this right-wing, very powerful media establishment. And he didn't know what to do. He couldn't build an alternative sort of coalition. And at the same time, the Brexit campaign was assisted by certain objective factors. The Eurozone crisis meant that the European Union lost its reputation for economic competency, and at the same time, the refugee crisis appeared to legitimise or justify or was instrumentalised very successfully by the political racist agenda of Brexit. So, you know, to take that combination of sort of long-term and short-term factors, it's easy to build up a sense where Brexit starts to look a bit inevitable once it happened. But of course, you know, the referendum was at the end of the day only won very narrowly, of course.
I think that's important, isn't it, really? Because the margin was small. And I mean, I think all accounts, it's not just my account, just about every account of the referendum accepts that Leave, you know, worked very effectively, and Remain was very, very feeble in comparison, and very poorly focused and poorly led, and it had all sorts of problems. So I mean, it's quite clear that it's clear really from the accounts of, you know, Cummings himself, and or if you read Tim Shipman's book on the referendum, which was very useful trigger for me, the Leave campaign thought they could win, but they knew that they had to pull absolutely everything out to do so, and that appears to be justified. You know, when Cummings talks about the billion social media messages that they sent, and targeted, of course, so that people like us didn't actually see most of them during the campaign, and mostly focused on the last 10 days and targeted at relatively small section of the population, which they identified as potential voters. And this is where the really lurid racist propaganda comes in, because this was sent to the people who were receptive to it. And one of the things we know is that very significant number, something like 2.8 million, it's been estimated, habitual non-voters were brought out, and most of them voted Leave. You know, and these are the people, I think, that the crude racist material was directed at, while the rest of us were seeing the more supposedly more reasonable Boris Johnson stuff about managing immigration and having a better Australian system. So they were seeing this really targeted propaganda, and it brought people out. Well, we know, of course, that a lot of people who would have supported Remain were not brought out. So I think this again, I think it increases the importance of looking seriously at the campaigns.
Yeah, and one factor we haven't mentioned so far is the figure of Nigel Farage. I mean, some years ago now, when we did a podcast with Zoe's mate Peter Oborn, I mean he basically put Brexit down more than any other factor to the success of Farage as a political insurgent over the last three decades, or two and a half as it was at the time. You discussed the role of UKIP in the book. Would you go that far, Martin?
Not quite, no. I mean, I would say that Farage was necessary but not sufficient for Brexit to happen. I think he is a formidable political operator, and that he did play a very important role, and through him, UKIP played a really crucial role in building the support for the demands of Brexit. And basically what Farage did was to fuse the immigration and the anti-European causes, and in that way make opposition to Europe really popular. Because although, I mean, there was a lot of Euroscepticism in Britain before the referendum and before this period of Farage's campaigning, it wasn't active opposition. Even in 2015, at the time of the general election, the European Union was not one of the major issues. So it was something which had to be constantly built up, and it had to be linked to immigration in order to make Brexit popular. And so that I think is Farage's achievement. But I think what we have to emphasize is first of all that throughout the whole period that withdrawal from the EU became an issue, right, going right back into the early 90s, it was the Tory right as well as the insurgents who were raising these issues. There were their causes were always intertwined, and at key points, it was the case that it was the Tories who were making the running. Certainly before Farage became the leader in the late 90s and early 2000s, the Tories were making the running as much as the insurgents. And so I think we have to see these things as being interconnected. And of course, Brexit only really happened when Johnson's and Gove's campaign took up Farage's mantle and used Farage's methods. That's really one of the key things I'm trying to say here, that the vote leave basically borrowed Farage's approach wholesale especially in the later stages of the referendum campaign. And that was how they were able to be victorious. And the other thing that I think is very interesting is the degree of overlap in Tory and UKIP support before the referendum as well as afterwards. So research has shown that two-thirds of the people who voted Leave in 2016 voted for or supported UKIP in the previous 2 years at one point or another, in one of the elections or another. And of course, we also know that after the referendum in 2019, the same people who put Boris Johnson into power in December had voted for Farage's Brexit Party in May. So, you know, there's this huge overlap of agendas, of to some extent of personnel, of ideas, especially, and of political support in the electorate for UKIP and the Tories.
Brexit has happened, and many of the things we warned about are coming true, but no one seems to want to talk about it. Here at Another Europe, we say it's time for meaningful accountability and real scrutiny, and that's where our new project, Brexit Spotlight, comes in. We're breaking the silence and shining a light on the calamities. Find out more at brexitspotlight.org.
You discussed the failure of Remain to tackle the racism of the Leave campaign. What do you think that was rooted in? And this is a bit of a follow-up, but do you think the Labour Party now is making the same mistake all over again?
I think the failure of Remain to tackle racism into the general failure of the Stronger In campaign, which was led by Cameron and which was basically under his control, and which decided that the issue was the economy and the danger of damage to Britain's economy from Brexit, and that immigration was a Leave issue, and therefore Remain shouldn't really touch that. So that position, and of course that campaign was overwhelmingly the one which got the media attention, and it was overwhelmingly a Tory campaign, even though it had some Labour figures involved in it. And then of course there's also the question of the Labour Party, isn't there, and why the Labour Party, because of course a lot of the backdrop to the referendum campaign is the Scottish referendum campaign 2 years earlier in 2014, and I think we can accuse Cameron of not having learnt from the near failure of the Better Together campaign in Scotland, the arrogance which went with that. We can also, I think, say that the fact that Labour learnt from the Scottish referendum that they shouldn't be merged in a Tory campaign, they should have their own campaign. And so then we have to look at what that Labour campaign was. And of course, Corbyn handed it over to Alan Johnson, who wasn't a shadow cabinet member, who has been in many ways, and it ran. It was generally, I think, regarded as a rather mediocre campaign, but also, and similarly, the trade union campaigns focused basically on the economics, not touching much the immigration. And I think it reflected a number of things. But I think one is the fact that the Labour Party as a whole, left and right, is more comfortable with economic and social issues, and finds it difficult to deal with the nationalist and racist sort of issues. It secondly affected the fact that the Labour rights and the centre, a lot of the Labour Party was thoroughly compromised by the Blair years on immigration, and basically accepted the demand for immigration control and didn't want to challenge it. And then the ambivalence of Corbyn himself about the referendum, and basically the decision of the Labour Party, the leadership, not to invest in the referendum, to play it low key. I mean, Corbyn even went on holiday during the referendum. It's I think you put all those things together, and we could talk, of course, about what happened afterwards with the question of freedom of movement and the way in which the Labour right and the Corbyn leadership essentially coalesced around the abandonment of freedom of movement. There's all of that. And I would say, in answer to your last point, in a sense, yes, isn't it? Yes, I mean, Starmer seems to be so fixated on the red wall and on a rather misleading interpretation, I think, of what happened in the Red Wall and what the Red Wall, so-called Red Wall electorate, is about, that I think it's going in the same way again, yeah.
This feels like an important question, so maybe it's fitting that it's the last one before we get into extra time. But we basically have a Brexit government now. I think in the book, and you mentioned it earlier too, you rightly draw a link between Theresa May's approach to these questions, and especially on immigration, and the current Johnson administration. So this is a kind of Johnson regime, is a kind of government of political racism. What are the key ways you think that this has shaped his agenda and policy after 2019, and also in the election, of course?
I suppose what I would say is I think that the you do have to see the Johnson government as in some senses a continuation of the Theresa May government. The basic shift took place in 2016-2017 when May's government decided that ending freedom of movement was the red line, and because of that, leaving the single market was also absolutely essential. She then, after she found out what leaving the single market would mean, tried to row back a little bit. She never compromised on the centrality of controlling immigration and ending freedom of movement. And so that is I think that's the baseline. That was the baseline for Johnson's Brexit. But he, of course, also indulged even further the far right in the Conservative Party, the ERG, and played even more with the idea of hard Brexit no deal Brexit, and then introduced a very hard Brexit, which we are seeing the consequences of today. So there's that framework. I mean, the other side of it, if we call it a government of political racism, that really, I suppose it first, I would say what we would mean there really would be the way in which the government operates in campaigning mode. I mean, there is some there are debates which are important debates about what is happening with immigration policy. And there are people on the liberal left who emphasize the slight liberalization which has occurred of some aspects of immigration policy and the way in which Johnson has abandoned the net migration target, which I think is just basically a sensible tactical move from his point of view, but it doesn't as such reflect anything very substantial. But also has made the relatively liberal offer to Hong Kongers, for example. There's that all these elements, the tweaking of the rules about income thresholds, so which have enabled more skilled Indians, for example, and professional workers to come into Britain. These things have been emphasized by some commentators. What I think is important is also the fact that we have to see these alongside the continuation of the hostile environment under another name, the dramatic deterioration of conditions for many Europeans in the UK, because we have to bear in mind that what Johnson has done what Brexit has done is to create a class of people who beforehand basically had citizenship rights because they were EU citizens and Britain was part of the EU, but who now are now dependent on settled status. And of course, many of them have not got full settled status. They have only got temporary rights to be in the UK. And at the margins, there are all sorts of people who are falling through the cracks and who are being basically falling into the general hostile environment policy. So I think we have to see this as the fundamental framework which is being maintained and deepened by Johnson. Where the political racism comes in is very much in the campaigning mode of the government. And the government, this government has got very little substantially to offer the British people, the electorate, the people who voted for them. And so it's very important for them to keep plugging these sort of racial themes, which we're seeing mainly at the moment around asylum and refugees and with the anti-refugee bill.
The further relationship to institutional policies that this kind of racist agenda has that we haven't touched on, but you see it, all over Europe and indeed the world, is the way in which these ethno-nationalist racist ideologies are used to justify power, centralisation and attacks on the rule of law. You see that with the Human Rights Act consultation. And of course, we see it too in the elections bill as well, this real dangerous closing down of the rules that underpin fair democratic competition. One thing that occurred to me when I read the book, you quote Robbie Shilliam's argument that today's far-right authoritarians, or this new authoritarianism, are either neoliberal by design and intention, or they are neoliberal in effect. And of course, neoliberalism, for a bit of explanation, for listeners, I think it's a word we use quite a lot on this podcast, but it's that package of ideas associated with Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan that stands for free markets, private enterprise, the idea that market competition is always good and that state intervention is always bad and states should get out of the economy as much as possible. So I think I'm not sure whether Robbie is right about this myself. It seems to me it's much more eclectic and pragmatic than that formulation would suggest. I suppose in the current context you see in the UK, you see on the one hand these quite interesting Tory proposals motivated absolutely by pragmatic problems in the energy market to renationalise large parts of the national grid, essentially, in order to try and deal with the energy crisis, recognising implicitly that markets in energy have completely broken down. Then at the same time, you have a perfectly successful public company that's working for public need, like Channel 4, and they're going to try and sell it off. So I'm not sure whether this policy is entirely neoliberal. I think it's more eclectic than that, that it borrows from both neoliberalism and Keynesianism. And in a way, it just reflects a kind of structural change in the global economy where markets are becoming much more dysfunctional and much more dependent on state intervention. So I just wondered what you thought about that, Martin, to conclude what has been a great discussion.
Well, when you highlighted that in an email to me, I went back to the quote from Robbie in which I use in the book. And he went on to say that not only are most racist populists also neoliberals in the sense that you were suggesting, but he said they are most are also the spoilt sons of Thatcher, who are less concerned by grand philosophical designs for remaking the human subject and far more interested in scams and short-term financial leveraging. And I think this, I probably included the quote as much for that second sentence as the first one, because I actually agree with you. I agree with you about the eclecticism. I think that the first point that you quoted from Robbie is the rationale for that really is that the Brexit right and most of the people who make up the Johnson government are the sons of Thatcher. They are the generation of Tories who were basically Thatcherites, and they come from the Thatcherite wing of the party. And this free market ideology has been central to the way in which they presented Brexit. So if you go back to Britannia and Change, the book that Dominic Raab and Kwasi Kwarteng and other people were involved in, it's about free markets, but not the European free markets. So they're making the shift which they're making, which becomes clearer later, not quite so clear perhaps in the book, is that it's the shift towards a different sort of free market ideology, which somehow excludes the UK from participating in the biggest free trade project in the world, which of course Thatcher herself had helped to design. But nevertheless, so it's this basically free liberal ideology, but it's enveloped in this peculiar nationalist anti-European phrasing. And I think beyond that, the eclecticism is very important. I mean, I do try to stress in the whole way in which I treat the ideology of the Brexiters, that the way in which it isn't really a primarily an ideological movement. I think those of us on the left, who try to think things through systematically and have to have coherent philosophical and political positions, sometimes attribute the same sort of thing to the right. So we think that there is a coherent neoliberal ideology which they're all trying to pursue. Well, the way I see the sort of forces that came together to create Brexit and which are now embedded in the Johnson government is more the way in which Robbie suggests in that second sentence that that they're basically people who are interested in their own and their mates' financial well-being in their power above all. What is Johnson about except his own power and prestige? And so they now, of course, they're in government. They have to do something about all the challenges which are facing the country, or at least appear to do so. And they, to some extent, they are thrashing about and trying to find solutions. So they're indulging their culture war policy with the Channel 4 privatisation, but they're also doing what you were saying about the national grid.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I think that we shouldn't imagine the Conservatives or any other right-wing force today as being motivated primarily by a kind of pristine ideology. But actually, maybe this is true, in the history of neoliberalism more broadly as well, that actually Thatcher was frequently more pragmatic than we might imagine in how she responded to events. Zoe, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. I was just thinking about it because I'm reviewing that Simon Cooper book, Chums, about the kind of trying to trace a through line from Oxford through from Eton to Oxford to the Oxford Union to Brexit, and it's very pacey, right? It's kind of pacey and interesting and readable, but it does miss this kind of fundamental thing that if they've got anything at all, it's the kind of emptiness where typically an agenda would be. You know, there's this void where the kind of they're kind of looped together like a string of pearls, but the string isn't an idea. It's just a kind of self-interest, as you say. And I just wonder whether we've thought hard enough generally in the discourse about that delinquency in the elites. You know, that it would once have been considered highly delinquent to have no kind of plan at all except self-enrichment. That would have been really weird.
Yeah, and I think the elite, this new elite as a kind of empty cipher, is a really interesting point, and power for power's sake. Because I think if you said to Boris Johnson or a number of other members of the cabinet, if you asked them what they think about Thatcher and whether they would describe themselves as Thatcherites, they would immediately say yes, of course. I think the large majority of them would. But they wouldn't necessarily have a very, I think, a deep understanding of the ideas that are the consequence of that kind of political commitment. And that kind of allows them to move quite opportunistically between policies, often shaped, I think, to some degree by the ideas that their civil servants present to them. And when, you know, we need to do this or the energy market is going to collapse, have you got any other ideas? No. Okay, then you go ahead and do it. You can sort of imagine the conversations in Whitehall playing out in that way.
Yeah. Let's go back to your book, Martin. I think that is absolutely right that if you don't have a coherent agenda apart from self-enrichment, you do need to find some reliable innovating force, of which racism is one and culture wars are another.
Yeah, nationalism, I suppose, is the third, which very closely tied up with both of them, really. And, I think you could over-ideologise the Tory party going, you know, throughout its history. Basically, I think it's been a party which has been concerned with power, with preserving wealth, you know, protecting the status quo, but it has adapted. It has appeared to have more ideological consistency in earlier periods, you know, and after the Second World War, for example, it was seen to have accepted a lot of the welfare state and sort of accommodated to it. And you know, there was a sort of what was we would now see as a more moderate sort of conservatism, which was dominant. But all the time, it was evolving and responding. And you know, I think that's still today. I think that's still there today. The difference, I suppose, is that Johnson, you know, with Brexit, especially with the ascension of Johnson, they have moved off at a very radical right tangent, really from, if you like, from the mainstream of European development, and they have put themselves in a position where they're causing all sorts of extra economic problems for the country. They are having to suddenly cooperate again with Europeans in NATO. They're suddenly, you know, because this has always been one of the contradictions, that they've been in favour of NATO but not of the EU. And they're facing these unprecedentedly big challenges, like the Ukraine war, like the energy crisis, which they don't have any real answers to. And so I think this is, you know, in these circumstances, we're going to see these sort of gyrations in policymaking as they try to find solutions which appear to work and which keep their political base intact for the next election, which I think is the bottom line.
Yeah.
Well, it's been really great to talk to you, Martin.
It has been great. It's a bit depressing, but it's great nevertheless.
We need to compensate this with a more uplifting discussion next time. But it's been great to chat, and congratulations on the book. It's a really important piece of work.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you, both of you. Thank you very much.